When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
Tesla did not get nearly enough shit for unveiling a cyber cab, their purpose-built robotaxi with two seats. Like, don't you want to go out with your friends or something? That just makes absolutely no sense. Hello and welcome back to the Plugged In Podcast, a weekly news show all about the future of transportation. I'm Tim Levin, senior reporter at Inside EVs. We've got a lot to get into this week. Lucid is getting into the robotaxi game, and batteries are still booming in America despite the big, beautiful bill. Plus, I speak with Stephanie Valdez-Streedy, director of insights at Cox Automotive, about a pretty rough quarter for EV sales and what's next for the EV market. But first, here to break down this week's news with me is my colleague Subrath. Thanks for being on the show, man.
Thank you for having me, Tim. I'm just sort of recovering from New York City flash floods. It was really bad on Monday. Thankfully, I was not caught in it, but one of my rooms was kind of dripping. So it feels like a good time to get like an inflatable boat or something.
Dripping and... with the New York City subway running like 6 feet from your window sounds very New York.
It sounds very New York, and it's yeah, this city just throws unpredictable stuff at you sometimes, but I think you're prepared for it.
Yeah, I'm glad to see you're dry, from what I can tell. So let's get into this week's news. We have a lot to cover. Here's some news I wasn't expecting this year. Lucid Motors, the EV startup, is getting into the robotaxi game. On Thursday, Lucid announced that autonomous gravity SUVs will hit the Uber network starting next year. The driverless hardware and software will come from Nuro, which is a company that historically focused on building autonomous delivery robots, but now is kind of pivoting toward licensing its autonomous technology to car companies and to rideshare companies.
Wow, that's I did not expect that from Lucid to move ahead so fast with robotaxis, because we're just seeing them ramp up their EV game right now. But it's sort of good to know that Tesla and Waymo are not the only players who are sort of betting on self-driving taxis. The whole field seems to be getting more crowded.
Yeah, definitely. And it's worth noting, before we get into kind of more of this Lucid news, how this is different from what Tesla's doing. Tesla's obviously, when you hear robotaxi, Tesla is like the number one company that comes to mind for most people, I think. So the difference is Tesla develops the technology, it builds the cars, and it wants to run its own robotaxi network via its own app. So it wants to be everything. And that's
fully,
the service.
Fully vertically integrated, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the service that we're just starting to see the beginnings of in Tesla's backyard in Austin, Texas, versus the way this is going to work, which is Lucid is going to make the cars, the gravity SUVs, and also outfit them with Nuro's hardware, the sensors at its factory in Arizona. So that's the, you know, cameras, LiDAR, radar, all the stuff that you see on the top of the vehicle, all those gizmos. And then those vehicles will be on Uber's platform, and Uber will take care of actually matching, you know, rides to riders and maintaining the fleet.
That sounds a lot like what Google does with its subsidiary Waymo. So just for those who don't know, Google buys electric Jaguar I-Paces, and then Waymo retrofits all the software and hardware. So this Nuro, Lucid, Uber partnership sort of sounds similar. Do you know when I can hop into one of these self-driving Gravities?
Yeah, not that soon, it looks like. So Lucid says that a Nuro-equipped Gravity is already testing at Nuro's facility in Nevada. We're still a little bit of a ways out from actual commercial deployment. The service will launch in an undisclosed major U.S. city next year. Probably given where robotaxis exist right now and kind of where like the regulations line up for this kind of stuff, it's probably going to be, my bets are on California, Nevada, Texas, Arizona, maybe Florida.
I think it'll be somewhere in Texas too because of lesser red tape. And that seems to be the hotbed for all these robotaxis these days.
It could be, yeah. Historically, a lot they were really the early players. Like Waymo originally started in Arizona. It's just like less of a the roads are like less hectic than somewhere like San Francisco. You know, it's like good weather, that kind of thing. So expect it somewhere like that. And then there are big plans for the future. So Uber plans to deploy 20,000 of these Gravities to its platform over the next 6 years in dozens of markets around the world. That's what Lucid says. Those will be owned by Uber or by its fleet partners. And it kind of means that it seems like Lucid is getting 20,000 vehicle sales out of this deal, at least. We don't know exactly how, like what the terms of this deal are, but Lucid's going to be able to move a lot of Gravities through this partnership.
Yeah, that sounds like a big shot in the arm for Lucid. Like 20,000 Gravities is a lot. Each one costs how much? $120,000, I guess. And
right
on top
now,
of that,
yeah,
you
they start at like 100. You know, they'll maybe go down to 80. Maybe Uber will get a deal on them less than that.
Right.
But like, still, it's like I don't know, $1 billion+ in sales if they're buying them at close to retail.
That's pretty nuts. And you have driven the Gravity, right? I'm sort of jealous because I've only seen it in drag races so far. So what do you think? How do you think it'll make up for a robotaxi?
I have driven it. It's a really impressive vehicle, and I think it'll be a really good robotaxi. Like the Gravity, for people who don't know, this is Lucid's second vehicle. So its first one was the Air, essentially a Tesla Model S or a Mercedes S-Class competitor. Big, long, low luxury sedan, four-door. The Gravity is its first SUV, this big kind of van-like three-row SUV. And yeah, it'll be a good taxi. It's giant. Like it's very big on the inside. I should specify. It's not that giant on the outside, but it is really spacious on the inside, really nice to spend time in, really futuristic. So I think it'll be good. I think it'll be better than Waymo's Jaguars, which are actually kind of cramped and not that big on the inside.
And that also sounds sort of like opposite of what Tesla is doing with the Cyber Cab, which we saw last year. That's just a two-seater. Like if you're one passenger or two passengers, that's good for you. Like, but what for what do you do if you have a big group to move? Like you order multiple Cyber Cabs. I think Lucid is being smart about this.
Yeah, it doesn't take a genius to say, hey, maybe our taxi should be 5 to 7 seats, not 2. I think Tesla, just like as a side note, Tesla did not get nearly enough shit for rolling out, for launch, or not rolling out, but for unveiling a Cyber Cab, their purpose-built robotaxi with 2 seats. Like, don't you want to go out with your friends, you know, 2 couples or some kids or something? That just makes absolutely no sense. But the Gravity makes a lot of sense.
It does make a lot of sense. But I think there was some study that came out right after the Cyber Cab launch, which said that most most riders end up riding solo or in like couples. So maybe it still could make sense, the Cybercab.
Sounds sponsored by Tesla. Sponsored by the Tesla Foundation.
Possibly. But it's good for Lucid that they're taking this whole autonomous driving thing more seriously, because there was also this news today morning that came out that Lucid's ADAS, Advanced Driver Assistance Systems for the Air and the Gravity, will get the newer version of their Dream Drive Pro system, which is similar to your General Motors Super Cruise or Ford Blue Cruise or Tesla Autopilot. So that is now getting hands-free lane changes with a software update later this year.
Yeah, that's coming coming in at the end of this month, I think, to the Air, hands-free driving. And I think one of the things to note is, like, this is a big deal. This seems like a pretty big deal for Lucid, which is a company that, you know, they sell cars, they bring in revenue, but they're still really trying to get off the ground and scale up their business. And so 20,000 Gravities over the next few years, that's not a small amount for a company that the last couple of years has sold like 10,000 cars in total each year. And I feel like, honestly, just having, like, imagine a city like San Francisco or Phoenix or Miami, and you have these awesome looking Gravity SUVs driving around and people are ordering them on the Uber app. Like, I think that could be a kind of powerful marketing tool for a company that, like, its biggest problem is that nobody knows what it is, really, right? Like, this is what we constantly say about Lucid, is great cars.
Yeah.
Nobody knows what they are, you know? Nobody knows that they should buy them.
Outside of the tech world, I can totally imagine that nobody knows Lucid. But Uber has a massive platform. I think tens of millions of riders, I think.
That sounds about right. We'll double check that. But yeah, Uber has a huge platform. And I think this is, honestly, when you look at this news, I think it's easy to focus on Lucid, especially if you're, you know, an EV nerd like us. I think the real news here is Uber. Uber is quietly becoming absolutely dominant in the ride share, or in the autonomous ride share space. Like, if you remember, Uber was one of the original developers of autonomous cars. They were trying to do this because, you know, if you're Uber and you don't have to pay drivers eventually, that's really great for your business. Then an Uber autonomous car hit and killed a woman during testing, and they scrapped that whole program. Now they're back and they're just placing all these bets. They're like, we're going to be the infrastructure. We're going to be the network that all of the autonomous companies want to be on, so that you can have access to our millions of users. And so when you look at the number of deals they've been making lately, it is just insane. So Waymos are on the Uber app in Atlanta and Austin. That's the only way you can get a Waymo in those cities, is on Uber. And Uber just this week announced a deal with China's Baidu around autonomous vehicles. Self-driving Volkswagen ID buses are going to be on the Uber platform, powered by Mobileye technology. It also has deals with May Mobility, Wave, AV Ride, WeRide, and now Lucid and Nuro. So it's kind of just like, whoever wins the autonomous vehicle race, Uber is going to win, right? They're just like, we're going to spread out our bets here.
Yeah, I think they're just going full guns blazing with this whole AI robotaxi approach. I think in a couple of years, or maybe who knows, by the end of the decade, we'll have robotaxi Ubers everywhere.
Yeah, it's I think nobody really knows how quickly this whole business can really scale up. Waymo's been scaling up fairly quickly. It's kind of all happening a lot faster this year than it has in the past. We'll see how big robotaxis can get and how quickly and how safely. The other thing I'll note, which I missed earlier, is, you know, apart from Lucid basically being able to market and maybe sell a lot of these vehicles through this deal, Uber is investing $300 million into Lucid, which I kind of buried the lead there. That's a big deal for Lucid, for a company that is burning cash and is still spending a lot of money developing and building vehicles and hasn't turned a profit. So $300 million from Uber, pretty good news for Lucid.
That sounds like a huge sum. So sounds like Lucid is finally diversifying its funding. It's not just the Saudi investment firm. You finally have an American company also backing Lucid.
Yeah, of course. And what you're referring to is Lucid's public, but it is majority owned by the Saudis, and they keep getting money from the Saudis. So, yeah, Uber helps add to their war chest here for sure.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar with a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry. IQBar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ Mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to IQBar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's IQBAR.com, promo code KELLER20.
But let's talk about batteries, because we know that the big, beautiful bill is going to deal a blow to America's battery industry going forward, plain and simple. You know, fewer EVs being produced is going to be bad news for batteries, which were really growing or set to really grow like crazy in America. But despite all that, there was actually a shocking amount of battery news in the last week. So things are still moving in the right direction, at least for now. And so I'm glad to have you on, our resident battery expert, to help break down these big moves in the battery space.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. When it comes to batteries, I think the ship has already sailed, and the ship is so big that bringing it to a halt is going to be a lot of effort. So a lot of the battery investments that happened right after the Biden administration enacted the Inflation Reduction Act, which was sort of the landmark legislation the previous government enacted. So a lot of those efforts are now coming to life. So the biggest battery news this week was from Panasonic, which has sort of built a new factory. So Panasonic, which is a Japanese electronics and energy giant, claims, and I have to stress on that word, claims that it has opened the largest battery factory of its kind in the whole world. And that factory is not in Japan. It's not in China. It's in freaking Kansas City, in one of its suburbs called DeSoto. Like, no offense to Kansas, but who would have thought that the world's biggest battery plant would come to the US, despite everything that's been going on the policy side? We have a hostile environment for EVs, for batteries, for everything that's sort of related to clean energy.
Right. And we knew, I mean, we've talked about a lot on this show that a lot of the biggest investments from the IRA into manufacturing have gone specifically to these kind of Republican states and Republican districts.
Absolutely.
So how big is the world's biggest factory, world's biggest battery factory?
It's sort of hard to wrap my head around these headline figures, but Panasonic claims it's 4.7 million square foot. So that's about the size of 225 American football fields. And when it will be fully operational, we don't exactly know that when, but when it's running at full capacity, it will produce enough batteries to power 500,000 EVs every year. So in an interview with Bloomberg, the head of Panasonic in the US, Megan Lee, she said that the company is not feeling, and I'm quoting her, the company is not feeling the slowdown yet, and they're very bullish on this transition. So they're sort of aiming for full production this year.
Yeah, but that's not all. GM is also having a huge week for batteries, right?
Absolutely, yeah. General Motors has been on sort of a battery blitz over the past couple of months. They've been investing a lot in R&D. They have a few new chemistries that will come out by the end of the decade. But this week, General Motors and LG Energy Solution, they run a sort of joint venture in the US when it comes to batteries. So they're bringing the production of low-cost lithium iron phosphate batteries to the US. So lithium iron phosphate is what's commonly known as LFP. And these are the low-cost batteries that China has really mastered. So GM will upgrade its factory in Spring Hill, Tennessee, starting this year, and will begin commercial production of LFP batteries by the end of 2027. Also, this is the same factory that produces a bunch of Cadillac models. So I think the XT6, then you have the electric Lyriq, and also the Acura ZDX. And now it'll have a battery assembly line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it seems like, I mean, the big news here is not just that GM is, you know, expanding battery production. It's specifically that it is LFP batteries, these cheaper types of batteries. So tell us a little more about why LFP batteries are important.
Yeah, you're right. It's more about LFP coming back to America, because LFP was famously invented at the University of Texas at Austin by an American scientist called John Goodenough. And he that was really the moment when sort of when the battery research was booming in the US, but the US did not capitalize on that. The Chinese battery makers did. They were the ones who really commercialized it. They were the ones who rapidly advanced this technology and made EVs cheaper, because automakers believe that LFP batteries are absolutely important when it comes to making low-cost EVs. So it's a pretty big deal. And it sort of marks the renaissance of LFP in America. And another key thing to note here is that Korean battery companies are also pretty big when it comes to like commercialization of batteries, but they haven't taken LFP seriously. They've generally been good at traditional lithium-ion batteries, which are based in nickel chemistries. So nickel manganese cobalt, or nickel manganese cobalt and aluminum, which is sort of the subcategory of NMC batteries. But now it looks like LG Energy Solution is finally on board, because all these Chinese battery companies are doing so well with LFP chemistries. And on top of that, I think it's worth noting that Ford and Tesla are also heavily investing in local production of LFP batteries in the US.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this seems to be where the whole industry is kind of moving, really, you know, pushed by China to figure out how do we make batteries cheaper? How do we make EVs cheaper by putting cheaper, you know, LFP batteries in them? This is definitely a trend to watch.
100%.
Yeah. So moving on, one of the biggest criticisms that I hear about EVs is that, and this is like Facebook uncle post criticism, but you see it a lot, that these toxic batteries just go sit in the landfill, which I think is hilarious, because people got real passionate about the intricacies of waste disposal once EVs started taking off. They're like, wait a second, you know, oh my God, there's going to be things are going to go sit in a landfill, when they never thought once about that with anything else they've ever owned or bought in their entire life. But what these people don't get is that EV batteries are actually super recyclable. That is not the case.
You're right. We never thought about how gas cars are disposed all these years, and now suddenly there's all this backlash against how EVs age and the harmful, quote unquote, harmful chemicals in the batteries. Which brings us to the subject of GM partnering with a company called Redwood Materials, which is a battery recycling company started by a former Tesla executive who goes by the name of J.B. Straubel. So GM signed a non-binding memorandum of understanding with Redwood Materials And Redwood itself recently launched its new subsidiary called Redwood Energy, which basically specializes in converting used EV batteries into low-cost energy storage systems. So what does that mean? It can be anything from your backup home battery, like a Tesla Powerwall, to full-scale power supply systems for commercial applications like AI data centers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So how will this collaboration work between GM and Redwood?
So GM and Redwood already have some sort of collaboration going on all these years. GM was supplying used EV batteries to Redwood, and they are apparently, some of them are apparently powering an AI data center in Nevada, which is run by a private AI company. Now they plan to increase those efforts, like take it to a whole new level and expand this collaboration. So the key thing to note here is that unlike gas, which when burnt in cars, it's gone. And much of it doesn't even convert into meaningful propulsion. Most of it is just losses. So it either converts to propulsion or is released into the air, which, by the way, causes pollution and makes our air dirtier and releases toxic gases. With EVs, it's a little bit different. And I'll get to that in a bit. So when it comes to EVs, the whole recycling and repurposing industry is booming right now. And it's completely different from what happens to gas cars when they're no longer usable.
Right, right, totally. This is the cool part about EV batteries that I think most people don't quite understand, is that they actually don't always end up in a landfill. You know, these hundreds of thousands, eventually millions of EV batteries that are going to reach the end of their life, they can be repurposed. You can either, like Redwood Materials, you know, will take batteries and break them down to their component parts and use that to, you know, reprocess those materials so they can be made into new batteries. Or an EV battery, like we're talking about here with GM, an EV battery that has 50% of its capacity left kind of sucks to drive in a car because it'll have like 100 miles of range, but it can work perfectly fine as stationary energy storage, you know, that helps in the event of a blackout or whatever.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So in an EV, you need a significant amount of power load. So you need the battery to be functioning at its peak. But when it comes to these secondary use cases, even a battery which is like half its original capacity is perfectly good. So I'll mm-hmm. give you a simple example. So New York City had a record heat wave about 10 days ago. Temperatures were above 100 and I was like sweating all the time. So there were power outages across Brooklyn. Like, I don't know, like there were a lot of power outages. It was all over the news. So people were using their air conditioning a lot, and that strained the power supply. So in such cases, these energy storage systems, which are basically fundamentally backed by these used EV batteries, they can fill in. They can stabilize the grid and sort of help meet sudden surges in demand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it just goes to show batteries will keep being super important no matter what the federal government has to say about it. But now let's switch gears and talk about how EV sales are going so far this year. Here's my conversation with Stephanie Valdez-Streedy, Director of Industry Insights at Cox Automotive. All right, Stephanie, thanks so much for being on the show.
Well, it's a pleasure. I'm always looking forward to talking about electric vehicles, and especially with you, Tim. So looking forward to this conversation.
Awesome. I appreciate that. So I wanted to have you on to talk about this latest quarter of EV sales in the U.S. and kind of where things stand in the EV market 6 months into this year, into a very confusing and sort of fraught period for the EV market. You know, what sort of stuck out to me was like, this was a very different kind of quarter than I think most of us are used to following this market, right?
Yeah, you know, think back about December when we did our forecast for 2025. We had forecasted that the EV market share would be about 10%. And then each month during 2025, we're looking at that and saying, how do we adjust it, right? And so going into Q2, we thought this is probably going to see a decline. just based on all the headwinds that are coming. And so I think that's what's happening right now. We have all these uncertainties, not only around the IRA that's going away, but there's tariffs. So I think that's kind of what's happening. And I'd also, but I do want to mention that with any new technology, you know, you're going to see this huge spikes. We saw really amazing growth, like 23 to 24. And I think with any new technology, you have to expect that you're going to have accelerations, decelerations. So I think this is part of it. I think the future is electric, but we've just in this new roller coaster EV, clouds of uncertainty, and we're going to have up and down throughout, you know, the next few years.
Right, right. And I guess part of it and part of the thing that I try to remind people, and I wonder if you agree, is like, it's such a small market in like comparatively, right? Compared to the
right.
new vehicle market, it's so small. There's so many fewer serious players and serious models that it's kind of like any fluctuations in like one or two models can really, or one or two companies can really throw off kind of the way the whole picture looks, right?
Yes. And, you know, I was glad you brought that up because I was looking at the data. So if you look at Q2, if you take out Tesla, it's pretty flat.
Mm.
If you look year to date, we're up about 1.5% year over year. So that's good news. If you take Tesla out of the year to date numbers, we're up about 14%. So to your point, Tesla is such a huge dominant player. If they change prices or if their sales decline, it has an overall impact on the market because they're so big. So mm-hmm. I think you're right. And on the other side, you have GM, right? Who is kind of the rock star during Q2 and this year with all the different models they have. I think for them, they have this portfolio that's different segments, luxury, non-luxury. So they're well positioned. And then the Equinox, I think it's well priced. So it's really resonating.
Right, right. And so I guess just to like set the stage, I would like to get into the kind of winners and losers and sort of the reasons behind some of that. But to set the stage, you know, like you said, first half of this year was actually a record for EV sales, up 1.5% year over
right.
year. Q2, however, not as strong. Q2 specifically down over 6% from last year with a little over 310,000 EVs sold. So what do you think is the, you know, when I'm kind of looking down that list of, you know, you're looking down the list of the models.
Right, right.
Almost all of the models that were on sale in Q2 of last year are down some percent in Q2 of this year, which is really dragging down that whole market. What do you think is behind that? You know, you mentioned just like general sort of headwinds and uncertainty. Like,
yeah.
What are the specifics that you could point to of like, yeah, this is why, you know, all of BMW and all of, you know, a lot of these other brands are just like down year over year.
Yeah, I think a lot of it is kind of just the, if you think about like the Prologue, right? I think it's fairly new. I think consumers are looking something fresh. And so some of those models in there, but I also think it goes back to those manufacturers or dealerships at the local level having really attractive marketing, leasing, financing deals.
Mm.
And so I think that's really helped with those. And I think the incentives, and you know, we talked about the headwinds with the IRA going away, but the manufacturer incentives have been really powerful too. If you look at like the ZDX, that did mm-hmm. really well, but I was looking at the incentives for that model are pretty high. And so I think that's the other driver too. If you look back at some of these models that are doing really well, there's probably some really good incentives on those as well. In addition mm-hmm. to like good marketing and word of mouth, that's really helping to sell those models specifically.
Right. So is it then that, you know, yeah, so a big part of EV sales in general are these incentives, especially for leasing.
Right.
That the manufacturers are handing down that are subsidized by the tax credits. On the flip side, when you see, you know, when you see model sales or brand sales go down year over year, does that indicate to you, or is a part of that that, yeah, that manufacturer is deciding to kind of pull back a little bit on its pricing and, you know, kind of let the market decide a little bit more?
Yeah, I think that's happening. And I also think some of this could happen by model if there's changeover in model years or if they're moving production. You look at like the Kia numbers, those are really down. I know they've had some shifts from production to the Georgia plant, shifts in model year. So supply, you know, production can be some of that. Mm-hmm. But then I also think to your point, it could be around just what's the, like with consumers, what's that best price out there that I'm going to get for that EV that I want? And those are the ones that mm-hmm. are going to really sell.
Right. And so what about the, you know, what is the role of demand, of consumer sort of demand and interest here? I guess that is very much related to pricing. But are we also just seeing like, you know, the kind of continuation of what we've seen for the last maybe year, year and a half or so, which is like, it's getting harder and harder to sell EVs in general. Like you're hitting this mainstream buyer. Yep. They're maybe not jumping at that lease or at that EV at that higher price. And so, yeah, like EV sales are just, you know, the manufacturers are figuring out how to sell these things to a new public.
Yeah, I think it goes back to kind of those main barriers, right? We've been doing an EV adoption study for the last few years, and price, always one of the top barriers, along with infrastructure, battery range, ability to hold its charge. So I think it's all about that price parity. And so in this EV market, right, we need vehicles that are affordable, that have that price parity with their ICE counterpart. And so I think that's, you know, once we have that, right, I think, or more options like that, I think that's going to be the game changer. If you think about China, right, where you can buy an EV or a plug-in for less than an ICE, it's working. So I think at the end of the day, that's going to be something that's really going to have to move forward. And I know we're going to continue to see battery innovation, which is going to help with range, density, and then hopefully over scale, reduce the price of those batteries. Because mm-hmm. as you know, with the battery, with the EV, it's all about the battery, up to 40% of the cost. So it's still going to be critical to get that battery price down. But I think that's one of the major issues, right? But I also think the other thing, as we move into this, you know, early adopters to the more mainstream, education. I don't mm-hmm. think all the stakeholders involved have done the best. I think there's more to be done in terms of education, in terms of selling. What's that value proposition for an EV, especially depending where you live? You might live in a state where there's maybe some state tax incentives. The price of utilities low, gas is high. It might be the prime place to buy an EV. So I think just more education about the value proposition of an EV is going to be important moving forward.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, like there may be plenty of people who, you know, actually when they, if they were to get down to it and say, well, yeah, I actually do have a home charger and like, this is right. how much I drive in a day and my commute maybe isn't that long. There's a lot of probably untapped potential in terms of just the people who like, you know, have garages, have a good income and like, don't drive that much, right?
Right, right. And yeah. I think going to like diving deeper into that, the used EV market, that's even like even more of a value proposition. If you can get a used EV, the last couple of months, the price difference has been less than $2,000. And so from that perspective, if you're going to get a vehicle for pretty close to the ICE vehicle and you're going to have lower maintenance, you're going to have less, you know, cost for charging versus putting gas, I think that's really powerful statement too for those people that are interested in EVs. Used EVs will be a really good option. And as you've seen with our leasing data, we're going to start to see a lot of EVs enter the market in the next few years. And so there's going to be a lot of options for consumers at different price points and segments.
Mm-hmm. Right. So like even as the new market is kind of slowing down, not growing as fast, we may see a lot of growth in that used market and potentially, you know, mainly just because, yeah, that's the way that like, if you want an EV that doesn't cost $40,000 or $50,000 or $60,000,
right.
like it's going to be used and there's going to be what, hundreds of thousands, maybe over a million of those coming off lease in the next couple of years.
Yes. Yeah. Close to a million have been leased since 2022. And so that, yeah,
wow.
To your point, yeah, a lot of EVs leased. And the interesting thing too, it's kind of like talking about Tesla, even Tesla, who historically hadn't done a lot of leasing, has started to pick it up in the last few months.
Mm.
So I think people have lots of Tesla options to choose from, and they currently do right now at a good price. So I think mm-hmm. that's another area that's going to, like a shining point of all this.
Right, right. So we talked about kind of in terms of like Q2 and why it's down. I mean, I guess there's just a volatility to this market. There is, you know, the general sort of, you know, uncertainty that consumers have around going electric. There's potentially the shifts in incentives and pricing. What else, like, part of what we haven't talked about is just kind of general, you know, unease around the economy. And maybe, you know, even if the policies aren't gone yet, I wonder if there's just kind of a vibe shift among the public with this, just like, okay, like, let me pump the brakes. You know, I'm hearing all this bad stuff about EVs. You know, the government isn't into them. So yeah, maybe I'll just like hold off or wait. Do you think that plays a role here?
Yeah, no, I definitely think the economy, if you look at just, you know, tariffs, right? That's the big thing, especially automotive, you know, looking at tariffs, no matter if the EV, which about two thirds are built in the US because Tesla really drives that, but even those vehicles are vulnerable to the parts tariff, right? And so I think to your point, consumers are thinking about, wow, things are going to get more expensive. Do I really need a car now? Maybe I'll buy one now. Mm-hmm. And that kind of shifts the volume increases that we saw earlier this year. But then it also might be, if you don't need one, you might think, you know what, I'm just going to wait this out and see what happens. And then I don't know if you recently saw a copper tariff that's, you know, another one that's going to come. And that could even, from an EV perspective, EVs have more copper than ICE vehicles. And so that could be something else that could kind of more impact EVs, I think, in terms of price. But I think, yeah, I think there's a lot of uncertainty with consumers. And we're starting to see that in the data if you look at consumer sentiment and consumer spending. So I think that definitely a lot of uneasiness right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I guess if you're the type of person who's like, yeah, you're like, maybe I won't, you know, spend that extra money I have on a new type of vehicle that I've never driven before at this exact moment in the economy, right?
Right. Yeah. And also too, I think consumers, and this goes back to more of the EV adoption. In our EV adoption study, when we asked consumers who were considering buying a vehicle but not an EV, when would be a good time? And they said 3 to 5 years, like 64% of people said that. And so that was just kind of an insight to think about. I think consumers are thinking in the next few years, we're going to have more infrastructure, reliable, accessible infrastructure. There's going to be more options for EVs. They're going to have more range, all that. So I think that's another thing. I think in terms of consumers, just kind of waiting for that technology to improve.
Mm-hmm.
Reseed is just such an attractive option for not only dealers. It's an effective selling tool. But for consumers, right, I can lease an EV at a lower monthly payment. I can test it out, maybe not ready to buy one, and then I can lease this until a new one comes out with more battery technology, and I don't have to worry about depreciation or residual values. So I think that's, like, there's a lot of reasons I think it's a huge success.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess that speaks to that 3 to 5 years, you know, sort of timeline. Is like a lot of people are thinking, well, you know, the options out there are good right now, but they might be even better.
Right. The other interesting that we haven't really talked about is just kind of what, like, manufacturers, I think, you know, they're definitely shifting timelines of when they launch. You've heard in the news, like, oh, you know, Nissan's going to delay their two SUVs or EVs in the Canton plant, Honda stuff. But I think we're still seeing, I think, innovation with battery supply chain. You saw GM recently announce about the LFP that they're going to really invest in some more to get those going. So I think manufacturers are committed. They're just shifting their timelines too to adjust to the market. But still, I think, and this goes back to when you mentioned the winners and the losers, I think those that are able to navigate this uncertainty and still innovate during uncertainty and still make progress in this space and be positioned when things start to take off more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So who do you think, I mean, yeah. So to bring it back to this half and this quarter, who's doing really well this year so far in your mind? I mean, is, we mentioned GM, Honda, and Acura. Are those kind of the big winners, if you could call them that?
Yeah, I definitely think so. And, you know, it's interesting. I'm really going to watch what happens to Hyundai Group with the Kia and Hyundai brands, because they were doing really well. And then this, you know, the last few months, they've just started to slow down in their sales. But they have, you know, they have the Ioniq, which does really well, still does well. But I think they're going to start to pick up, because I also feel like they're well positioned. They're investing in EVs. They're doing a lot of marketing around it. So I think they're going to continue to do well. But definitely GM, the Honda, and Acura is part of that. The other one that no one talks a lot about is Nissan. I used to work at Nissan. Mm. And I was there when the Nissan Leaf launched. And it's so interesting to see how the market's evolved. And hopefully the new Leaf does well, you know, better than the other one. But the Aria has done pretty well in Q2. And so I think Nissan's one that's, you know, starting to pick up a little space. I know they have some other issues, but I think in terms of just Q2 numbers, they fared pretty well in terms of that and overall. And also some of the smaller luxury pure EV brands, you know, Polestar, Lucid, small numbers, but definitely picked up a little momentum. And the other one that we're starting to see, it'll be interesting to see where those go, are the Stellantis, you know, the Jeep and the Dodge, small volume, but starting to play their player now and see where they go.
And so what do you think is going on with, I don't know if you have any insight into Hyundai and Kia, because that is one of the weird ones where we've been tracking them for so long. They put out, you know, what we believe are some of the best EVs you can buy. Like, those are some of the ones that we recommend. Everybody's loved them. What do you see going on there? Do you think that is a supply sort of problem? Do you think that's a demand thing going on with the Kia EV6 and some of these other cars? What's up with the Hyundai and Kia?
I don't, you know, I need to dig into this deeper and find some facts to share with you, but
I'm
just looking at it, I think it has to do more with the supply. And I'm thinking about when they, you know, model year changeover, that can impact sales, moving production to the Georgia plant, back to, you know, create bottlenecks in the supply chain, stuff like that. So I think that could be some of it. But to your point, I think they're well-made vehicles and I think they'll continue to do well. And like, once again, even looking at the data, the Ioniq was number four, I think. Yep, number four in Q2, right behind the Chevrolet Equinox. So, So I think they're a brand to watch in Q3 and Q4.
Yeah, definitely. And then, so we have to talk about, in terms of the losers, we have to talk about Tesla. I mean, this is a brand that just has such an outsized share of the EV market. Anything that happens to Tesla up or down has a huge impact, as we mentioned earlier.
Right.
What's going on with Tesla right now? Like, they, in Q1 and Q2, sales were both down year over year. What's your read on kind of Tesla's situation in the marketplace right now?
You know, I think Tesla, so I think about, like, I know Tesla is positioning itself as more than a car company, right? It's an AI, robotics, autonomous company. But if you look at their core business, the automotive business, it's a car company. So like any car company, when you don't have new products, you're going to start to see competitors start to eat at that share. And so if you look at Tesla, they haven't had any new product other than the Cybertruck, which is very niche. And that was down 50% in Q2.
Yeah.
And so I think that's part of it. They had the refresh with the Y, but that was still down. Surprisingly, in Q2, the Model 3 was up. So that was that was something positive for Tesla. But I think without any new product, I think that's been a challenge for Tesla. The other thing, there's three things, I guess. The product, and then second, I think they have that competitive advantage with the charging network, which they opened up, which I think is so important for the industry. I think we need standardization around charging, so that, like a gas car, right? No matter where you go, you charge, you know how to pay. So that, and then I think Elon, right? Elon can be very polarizing, I think. So that could have some impact on the brand. And so I think the combination of all that is something that, you know, is really pushing those sales away from Tesla into other, like GMs and then some of those other brands that really picked up some of that market during Q2. So I think without some new models, we haven't had any details on that affordable model that has been mentioned in the past, but I think that's going to be critical for them to have a new model. The one thing, though, I will say about Tesla, because, you know, they've been at it, and even like you said, you look at the numbers, they're still way ahead, right? They've been at a long time.
Not even close.
Right, yeah. Right. So they're still, I mean, they can turn it around, but I think it's just car company and there's lots more competition They're competing with all these new models that are being launched. But they do have, if you think about vertical integration, they're the one that's profitable. I know they've had some carbon credits in the past that have helped with that, but they definitely have this vertical integration where they source a lot of the stuff for their vehicles. And so that gives them a competitive edge. And while the other manufacturers are trying to build that up, they're already there for the most part and building on that. So I think they're going to have new product, continue to innovate on their technology, which other competitors are catching up on, and maybe do some new remarketing campaigning with consumers to rebrand a little bit.
Yeah. And so when you see the Model Y, you know, this was kind of like not a new model, but a Tesla, like, for a company that like really rarely or takes a long time to update its models, like this is a big deal. Refreshed Model Y, year over year, the refreshed Model Y did worse than the old Model Y did last year. Does that tell you that it's not really doing its job, that this refresh is not doing its job, not as successful as it could have been?
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And that's why I just need a new model, right? Something that consumers can look at, something new. I mean, consumers love new stuff. And you can, if you think about like the GM with all those, like whether it was in the Cadillac, they have the Lyric, the Optiq, the Vistiq, and they have the Escalade, you know, one after another, different options. And I think that's really been helpful. And that's what Tesla needs, is some more product options or offerings for consumers.
Yeah. And you mentioned, you know, all these new models being introduced. You mentioned in your report that more than a dozen new models were introduced over the last year, and yet still sales are down. What does that tell you about the market? Does it mean that, you know, these are not the model, like new models are great. We've always been talking about like this market needs new models and needs, you know, there are people who are brand loyal. There are people who will only buy it if it's a Subaru and they won't buy anything else. So that helps. But also we're seeing all these new models introduced and still sales are down. So what does that tell you? Does it mean that those models are not affordable enough? They're not the right fit? What does it mean?
Yeah, I think it's affordability. And then I also think just it's like you mentioned earlier, it's hard. Like once you start to move into this more mainstream, it takes a lot more work to get consumers to think about that as an option. So I think you have that. But then the other thing too, I think is another thing that's happening is consumers are also looking at hybrids, gas hybrids, plug-in hybrids. There's a lot of options, especially for gas hybrids, right? You don't have to change anything. It's like driving an ICE vehicle. You don't have to worry about charging. You get the fuel efficiency, some environmental benefits. So it's a no-brainer. So I think some of that too is happening. Consumers are like, you know what? Maybe I'll try a hybrid before I go to consider full electric. So that could be some of it that's coming into play.
But I like definitely, maybe that's, yeah, go ahead.
No, yeah, that I think, and just going back to having some more affordable models, it'll be interesting to see how the Bolt does.
Yeah, yeah, the new Chevy Bolt coming out, I think at the end of this year, that should be huge. I mean, we did a piece recently about the cheapest EV models in America. And none of them are cheap at all, basically.
Right, right.
There's the Equinox EV, which, you know, maybe it's worth double-clicking on that for a second. That was a huge winner so far this year. It's now the best-selling non-Tesla through the first half of this year. And largely because it costs $35,000, I'd imagine, before any tax credits.
Right, right. I think, like you said, it's all about affordability, which goes back to the data about barriers for adoption,
right?
When you start to move in. And so I think until we can get more options like that, it's going to impede adoption.
Yeah. And so I guess we'll round out some of the winners and losers. I think we covered the winners, the losers. The last one that I see here that I think is maybe notable, and you can tell me if there's others that you want to talk about, is just Ford, which I think maybe is also suffering from a Tesla-like problem of, and they're admittedly just not investing in models right now. They have some stuff coming out later this decade, but like they're basically working with the same models they had on sale last year, and so their sales are down. Is that Is that kind of your read on their situation as well?
Yeah, I think it's the product. And I know like they had, you know, canceled the three-row SUV and talked about focusing on their core, which was big trucks, mid-size trucks and commercial. And I think the one thing that's helped them, like, but even looking at the data, like for Q2, the Mustang was still in the top, you know, number five. Mm-hmm. And that's surprising to me, right? With like, with no new models, that Mustang's kind of hanging in there. But I think for Ford, the one thing that's helped them is that maybe the Ford promise with the home and then the home installation, free charger, I think that's helped them. But they definitely also need some product. And you can see, if you look at the market share declines, right? I think that's just indicative of their product portfolio and not having anything to provide to consumers that's, you know, shiny new vehicle to launch.
Mm-hmm. It's really interesting when you look at the difference between Ford and GM's strategies here. You know, and Ford even kind of poked fun at GM in their second quarter release. They were like, well, unlike, you know, we have much higher per model sales than our competitor. Do you have a sense of like which one of these strategies you think is the better one? Like you have Ford and they're right? The Mach-E and the Lightning sell way more than if you pick out most of these GM vehicles.
Right,
GM now
right.
has like, I don't know off the top of my head, like 10 or 12 EVs,
yep.
A bunch of Chevys, they have like three or four different EV trucks that are splitting that instead of Ford just having the Lightning. So it seems like GM's kind of like spreading their bets across a bunch of different models. Ford is kind of focusing more on just a few. What do you make of those differences?
Yeah, I think it's funny you mentioned that because I was looking at the number of models per OEM, the manufacturing level. And you're right, like GM has like 12, Hyundai has like 12. Mm-hmm. And then you're right, like Ford has, like if you count the e-Transit, they have 3.
Yeah.
You know, I think they're different strategies. I think it's for GM, I think it's working right now, right? To have this diverse portfolio and have and I also think rolling out these, especially in the Equinox and the Blazer, models that are people are familiar with, the gas model. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's helped them. I think if you don't have models, I think you might, unless you come out with something that's really gonna like do well, you're putting yourself further and further further behind in the EV space. Mm-hmm. So I think they're just different strategies and I don't really know which ones, I mean, I think which one's better, but right now what GM's doing is working well for them.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's just interesting to kind of tease it out. Cause like it's working when you look at the total numbers, GM selling way more than, you know, they're second to Tesla now, selling more than the others, but then it's also spread out across so many miles.
Right.
It's like, how do those investments sort of pan out when you're selling, you know, 3,000 Hummers or whatever it is in a quarter? Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that works out over time.
I know. But I'm excited for, you know, like Ford to come out with something. Like I haven't heard anything. I don't know if you've heard anything on their Skunk Works team. I was trying to find out, like, if I could find anything on that, any progress, any timeline, anything else on that.
You'll have to let us know if you do. that's Ford's like secretive, you know, side project basically that's building their next generation EVs. Supposed to be an affordable model.
Right.
Around, I think they said around $30,000 or $35,000 and a next generation pickup truck sometime. So we'll see when those come out.
Right,
those will be good for Ford.
Right. Yeah, the other one that we didn't talk about was Rivian. You know, I love the Rivian brand, and I think the R2 will be really important to them. So I think next year will be a pivotal year for them to see what happens with that more affordable SUV that they're launching.
Right, right. So affordability is always relative in EVs. When we say affordable EV, you know,
right,
doesn't mean you can actually afford it. Yeah, no, I think it's the same thing, right? It's Rivian has two very cool and great products, but they haven't changed significantly. So they've got a, you know, that R2 is going to be the thing that really helps them grow.
Yeah. And luckily they have the VW partnership that kind of helps him navigate these uncertain times.
Right, right. And so speaking of uncertain times, I think we can maybe wrap up with just like, what do you expect to happen the rest of this year, right? We had kind of strong Q1, pretty weak Q2. The EV incentives are, the EV tax credits are all ending at the end of September. What do you expect to happen in the US EV space throughout the rest of this year?
Yeah, I think we're going to see Q3 probably an uptick in sales, just as for those people that are thinking about an EV, we'll go ahead and buy one. It's a good time to take advantage of those incentives, especially leasing. It'll be interesting to see how much leasing increases. It's already pretty high.
Yeah.
And then Q4, you know, I think it might depend on each brand too. There might be, depending on inventory levels, right? So we might see some brands do better at Q4, depending on production. But definitely a slowdown after Q3. And then going into 2026, you know, I think it's going to be dependent on like some states might, I think it might be some states might continue with adoption, whether you have places like Colorado or if California brings back the state EV tax credit where you live, you know, that may continue to help some of the momentum, but definitely see a slowdown for sure. And we had actually, I think, as I mentioned, 10%, now thinking about 8.5% will be the share for 2025 at the end of the year with all the stuff and changes that are going on.
Mm-hmm. So
pretty flat
volume, pretty flat this year. And like probably a very rocky end of the year of like potentially a record quarter in Q3 and then followed by like, who knows what in Q4, right?
Right, right. It'll be interesting. I wish I had a, you know, crystal ball that could tell us like what 2026 is going to look like. I mean, the good thing in terms of EV, like following, you know, the incentives are going away, but luckily the 45X is still, it's being phased out. So I think, well, you know, that is going to help with production and hopefully helping to build that EV battery supply chain here in the US. So that's one of the silver linings, I think, out of it, even though the consumer tax credit's going away. That's going to help increase, you know, production and innovation a little bit.
Mm-hmm. The 45X being the productions, the credit that most people, you know, on the consumer side don't know about.
Right, right.
This is not the buying tax credit, but the one that subsidizes EV battery production for the automakers.
Right.
So yeah, maybe despite all this uncertainty and, you know, a lot of policies going away, not all is lost, and 2026 could still be an up year, do you think?
I think it will. You know, I think we'll see increases, not at the pace that we would like to, but I think we'll still continue to see growth. And I also think, I always look at the, like, what if, like, all these uncertainties, it could spur more innovation, right? More innovation, more collaboration. So I think that's, you know, looking to, like, some of the positive around this. I think that we could continue to see that, even with infrastructure, right? Like, I know the NEVI was slow to ramp up, but we have a lot of good IANA, and we have some other public-private partnerships. So hopefully infrastructure will continue to grow, give consumers more of that optic that if I do choose to go EV, there's available charging, which is going to be critical.
I appreciate you leaving it on an optimistic note. That's great. Stephanie Valdez-Stridi of Cox Automotive, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tim. Have a good rest of the day.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar. With a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry, IQBar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs.
great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to iqbar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's iqbar.com, promo code KELLER20.
Now it's time for Plus Minus, our segment where we talk about who's up and who's down in the EV world. Suvrath, who you got this week?
I actually have a minus this week because I've realized that both times when I was on the podcast previously, I've only had good news. So I'm going to disappoint you today. So the big, beautiful bill which passed in Congress recently, that basically kills the legislation which made cars economical. It saved you money at the pump. So for half a century, these rules, which are called corporate average fuel economy rules, they sort of forced automakers to make efficient cars, and sort of gave birth to models like the Toyota Prius. But now, if companies don't make fuel-efficient cars, they won't face any penalties. So the penalties have been brought down all the way to $0, which sort of sucks. Which basically means that you're not penalizing polluters. So polluters get a free pass. So that's sort of my minus for this week. But I also want to note that this doesn't suddenly make cars inefficient, because cars which are on the road today were engineered years ago and they're designed to comply. And automakers are also like, they want to be consistent across the markets where they sell. So fuel economy rules are still in place in Europe and China, and they won't be suddenly selling inefficient cars in the US. We sort of run on similar platforms internationally.
Right. But it still is, you know, you look forward, car companies aren't going to have the same pressure, basically, to develop cars that are, you know, more hybridized, more efficient. Basically, the CAFE rules would set these escalating goals for miles per gallon. So, you know, you had to go from 30 to 40 to 50, whatever it was, over a course of years. And that still exists technically right now. The regulation still exists. But the big, beautiful bill kind of took this backdoor approach to killing it. And they were like, okay, we're just going to, instead of repealing it, because we can't do that through this budget bill, we're just going to reduce the fines to zero. So technically, it's like a box, I guess, that the automaker has to check. But then there's no penalty for not doing it. So bad news from the poorly named bill.
Right.
I have a plus this week, and it is Ayana. This is the EV charging kind of super company by 8 automakers, including Mercedes, BMW, GM, Honda, and Hyundai. News this week from Ayana, it announced that its 400 kilowatt charging stations are coming to Wawa gas stations, which is great news for EV charging in this country. It's great news for this really cool and really necessary company that is starting to move really fast. And with that news, it says that it now has over 3,000 charging stalls under contract and 212 live. So keep an eye out for an Ayana rechargery coming to a gas station near you.
Yeah, I've been impressed by how fast Ayana has sort of been able to move in the EV charging space. I'm also impressed by the fact that they're going to coexist alongside gas stations. So that's a nice juxtaposition, I guess.
Yeah. Good on you, Ayana. Like I think they opened their first charging station definitely under a year ago, and they've just been one after another. So good news for charging your car. Thanks for listening to the Plugged In podcast from Inside EVs. We'll be back next Friday. Today's show was produced by Michael Perkins and is brought to you by the Motorsport Network. Make sure to hit the follow button wherever you get your podcasts and tell a friend to tune in. See you next time.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar with a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry. IQBar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin-star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling Yuzu Mango IQ Mix Hydration Mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to iqbar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's iqbar.com, promo code KELLER20.